And it is 6:15, so we will start. Let me read out what I've put on the board, since I know this board isn't easily visible to everyone. This is a session on prophetic liberative practices, and there are three major themes of the traditions of prophetic liberative practices: justice-centered faith, shared power, and an unquenchable thirst for life. I put a few words up above here that I'll mention in the course of the evening. Sociality and solidarity, structural sin, and an image from Martin Luther King, the World House. This reads here, and we'll talk about this as well, nonviolent resistance as the means to three different ends. Rights for the disenfranchised, a different socioeconomic political order, and well-being of future generations. I have two questions that I want us to get to. One of them is, who are the women today carrying out the ways of the prophets? And I'm doing that because the examples that I'm going to share with you are Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Martin Luther King, and Mohandas Gandhi. And that leaves out the women, but the women are carry on the work of the prophets. So I want us to get to that. And then, how do we extend these legacies, the legacies of the women, King, Bonhoeffer, and Gandhi, for the sake of creation justice? I'll say, for the sake of recording this session, my name is Larry Rasmussen. And this is a series this week on Earth Honoring Faith. We have new villagers today. We have some villagers who've been around this week, but this is the first session. So I'll do the briefest of reviews and do it in a little different way than I have before. all you need to know to enter the conversation is already well said by James Baldwin. In The Price of the Ticket, Baldwin writes of doing our first works over. In the church I come from, which is not at all the same church to which white Americans belong, we were counseled from time to time to do our first works over. Go back to where you started, or as far back as you can, examine all of it, travel your road again, and tell the truth about it. Sing or shout or testify, or keep it to yourself, but know whence you come. To do first works over means to re-examine everything from the onset and to speak the truth as best one can. Now, first works are the works by which we expect to work out our geosocial salvation. They're always layered deep in psyche and society. Our first works, our basic works, our basic institution, our basic social societal character generate the very normative gaze with which we perceive things, that they frame our feelings and our thoughts alike. They fund our personal habits. They fund the habits of our institutions. They show up in our modes of production and reproduction, our cultural sensibility, our basic aesthetic, intellectual, and moral values, the contents of our symbols and our consciousness. Our first works are the ones that add up to, in a phrase, our way of life. And Baldwin says his counsel is we should, from time to time, do our first works over. What we've tried to say this week is that the way of life of global consumerism, and global corporate capitalism is so far out of phase with the planet's health and nature's economy that both we and our institutions have to change. The work is to recall Jesus, new wineskins for new wine. We have new wine, it's a changed planet. Moving from one geological age, the Holocene, to another, the Anthropocene. We've got new wine, but we're trying to put the new wine into old wineskins. The industrial technological era. We're trying to get that economy back on track, the same one that gives us climate change. But the old wineskins, if we take the parable seriously, will not hold. So, given the need for new wineskins, what might the shared, deep, millennial, cross-cultural traditions of the world's religions contribute? They themselves will need to be changed and enter their ecological phase. But they're living traditions. They can change too. And we've spent a little time with some of the deep traditions. So we asked, how might asceticism, notions of the simple life, in earth-honoring form, address global consumerism? How might the sacred, that which is worthy of reverence, address this relentless commodification of nature for market exchange, where there is no mystery and no sacred character left to nature that's commodified? How might the mystical experience of communion with all that is address the rather profound alienation of human beings from other than human nature? And today, how might the prophetic liberative traditions, what might they bring to this collective task of doing our first works over? These are kind of footnotes to today's Bible study, so it's a continuation of a conversation that started this morning. I sing the High Holy Days, called the Days of Awe, in a little congregation, Beit Tikva, in Santa Fe, and my colleague in the bass section, Bob Bortel, asks me every year, tell me again, where are you when you're not Jewish? So I have to tell Bob Bortel where I am when I'm not Jewish. The Yom Kippur service includes this. This is the Day of Atonement and the concluding service. We have prayed for impossible things, peace without justice, forgiveness without restitution, love without sacrifice. Those are impossible. Can't have peace without justice, forgiveness without restitution, love without sacrifice. The heart of prophetic liberative religious traditions is justice-centered faith. The key to prophetic liberative traditions is shared power. This comes up in all of them. And both of those are expressing the prophet's unquenchable thirst for life. I should also have probably put up there, the dream drives the action in the prophetic tradition. Martin Luther King, in the shadow of the Lincoln Memorial, did not say, I have a nightmare today. He had plenty of them. One of them killed him, the assassin's bullet. Lots of nightmares. Trembled over the kitchen table, wondering whether he should go on. But he said, I have a dream. I have a dream today. And you know the rest. So the fourth theme up here should have been the dream drives the action. In this case, the biblical dream for the triumph of life. And in that connection, like the laments of ascetics and like the laments of mystics, prophetic rage is the result of a vision violated and a dream deferred. Hope and redemption, peace and abundance are the dreams that drive the action. The first words and the last words. In earth-honoring form, hope is hope for the redemption of creation inclusively. The liberation of all life, from the cell to the community. And it's always a struggle, inclusive of the poor, the weak, the disenfranchised, the marginalized, the diseased, the disfigured, and not least of all, please note this in the prophetic tradition, it's the liberation of exploited and exhausted nature. The mountains shall yield peace for the people, and the hills justice. In the Torah, back to the days of awe, redemption is the freedom of slaves. Redemption is actually a word from economic life referring to freeing slaves. It's deliverance from oppression. The God of mercy and compassion who creates a people, a piru, who were no people, hews a way where there was none, experiences the suffering of slaves, and goes before them on a journey to what? To teeming land. So here you have in the oldest portions of the prophetic liberative tradition the picture of earth redeemed. It's a picture of abundant life with all nations streaming to the mountain of the Lord for instruction in the ways of peace. And for these Hebrew prophets, for the Hebrew Bible as a whole, the life of faith is justice-centered living. That's what righteousness means in the Hebrew Bible. A good life lived in good institutions. Right relations with one another, the land, and God. The fullest possible flourishing of all life is the outcome and the sure sign that justice reigns. Peace without justice, forgiveness without restitution, life, love without sacrifice are impossible things. Yom Kippur liturgy. My colleague at Union, Jim Cohn, kept pointing out what Martin Luther King kept insisting. Justice is an essential ingredient of Christianity as well as Judaism, yet most Christian theologians have failed to make justice their starting point. To the extent that that's true, the Hebrew Bible is abandoned, since in it righteousness and justice are at the heart of the covenantal relationship between God and the earth. The very calling of a people of God is to serve as a witness to the ethnoi, the Gentiles, the nations, of inclusive, righteous, community that extends to the land. And so you have it expressed in the practices, the Jubilee, where the land and the animals get to rest, and the debts are canceled, and the slaves are are free. Or the Sabbath, the weekly rest for all, including the land and the animals. I should add here that in the modern era, The ancient prophetic liberative traditions, which had a revival in the modern era and liberation theologies of many kinds, that old tradition gained certain tools that it earlier did not have. With the great social theorists, Marx, Durkheim, Weber, Sorel, and the development of social scientific analysis, prophetic attentions to systems and structures and policies and how they might be bent in the direction of shared and saving power attained a certain sophistication. The subtle and the profound ways in which human behavior and human character are patterned by the organization of nature and society together is the sociologist's insight. How life together is ordered, organized, makes it easier for people to be and do good and harder for them to be and do evil. Or conversely, the way in which society is organized, ordered, makes it harder for people to be and do, or makes it easier to be and do evil and harder to be and do good. And the social gospel and Christian realism and liberation theologies, together with progressive evangelicalism, have all learned that fashioning and refashioning institutions with focused attention to the organization and the distribution of power bears directly on righteous or unrighteous living. Now, the prophets are especially beady-eyed about practices. They want to know what you're doing, how you're doing, the habits you live by, the routines that are inculcated as our daily way of life. The practices of systems and structures are the true judges of how we're doing. Ideological claims, creeds, beliefs, rituals, the noise of solemn assemblies pale alongside routine practices as the measure of our lives. It's as if the prophets, now with this kind of sociological savvy, said, tell us your income and your zip code, and we will tell you how you live and the world it creates. We'll describe your education, your diet, your energy use, and transportation. We'll describe the housing you have, the company you keep, the way you spend your leisure time, and how you treat your neighbors in the world. Whether you're Christian or Buddhist, unaffiliated, gentle of spirit, or cranky all the time, or not, whatever your race, your ethnic identity and genes, your habitual practices reflect how your living is organized and carried out. Moreover, the prophet might say, the word of Jesus is the same as ours. Not all those who claim Abraham as their father or who call on God as their Lord are saved, but only those who do the Father's will, whoever or whomever they might be. Well, this legacy now, as I said, kind of gaining a certain kind of sophistication with the social sciences, has led to the discussion of structural sin in a lot of liberation theologies. The words can be blunt, as they are in the papal encyclical, The Gospel of Life. I'm quoting from that encyclical. We are confronted by an even larger reality, which can be described as a veritable structure of sin. This reality is characterized by the emergence of a culture which denies solidarity and in many cases takes the form of a veritable culture of death. This culture is actively fostered by powerful cultural, economic, and political currents which encourage the idea of society excessively concerned with efficiency. We thought that was a bad word. In this way, a kind of conspiracy against life is unleashed. Culture of death, conspiracy against life. I have set before you life and death, blessings or curse. Choose life so that you and your descendants may live. Deuteronomy 30. Now, those are the subtleties of prophetic discourse, such as they are. The prophets are just rarely incapable of nuance. So you get this kind of language and choice. As I mentioned, just with the Jubilee and with the Sabbath laws, these traditions, prophetic liberty traditions, also work then to institutionalize practices, since practices shape who we are and how we live. Okay. A few words on this focus in the prophetic tradition on power. How power is organized is always on the minds of the prophets. The proper structuring and restructuring of power, together with accountability to God for its uses, is near the center of the religious ethic of prophetic traditions. One example, in modern times, the rise of the environmental justice movement. It began with the summit in Washington, D.C., 1990, I think, of the summit of the people of color to establish the environmental justice movement, because the major players on environmental circles, Sierra Club, World Wildlife Resources, National Resources Defense Council, and so on, were not paying attention to urban ecology, urban neighborhoods, or the poor in the countryside. The preservation and conservation tactics weren't paying attention to the environment in which an awfully lot of people live. And so, as a protest against that, they established environmental justice movement. It was actually a mustard seed story. It was the Commission on Racial Justice of the United Church of Christ in 475 Riverside Drive. There were about four staff people that started all of this, and all they did was lay the U.S. Census materials over the top of a map of the toxic waste sites. That's what launched this. And what it showed was that poorer communities fared far worse than affluent ones as sites of commercial waste, toxic waste, poorer peoples of color fare worse than poor whites, and women and children within those communities fare worse than men. Then they looked at it worldwide and they found that the same was true. Poorer nations and poorer sectors within nations were the toxic, wrong side of the tracks, so to speak, which have always been more toxic. And thus was this launched. And it was launched as an inclusive justice where you sought creation justice. You sought justice for the peoples and the land together, even though those poor communities were not the source of the toxicity in their neighborhoods. It came from elsewhere. All right. Just maybe 10 minutes here. Let's talk about three exemplars of this prophetic liberative tradition in the 20th century. Alan mentioned Desmond Tutu this morning. I'm going to add Martin Luther King, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and Mohandas Gandhi, two Christians and a Hindu. Now, the coincidences of Bonhoeffer and King simply startle. Both Bonhoeffer and King died when they were 39 years and 4 months old. Both of them died in April, victims of the violence they sought to end. Both were true patriots who died because of, as well as for, their countries. Like other prophets, each loved his people enough to agonize and confess its wrongs, seek repentance for its crimes, and pursue the dream of a nation and a people that lived up to its own best promise. Both reached a fateful turning point at age 26. King, when the Montgomery bus boycott threw him into the nascent civil rights movement. Bonhoeffer, when the appointment of Adolf Hitler as Reich Chancellor by Hindenburg set the young 26-year-old university professor on the path of costly grace. Prophets don't choose their own moment. In graduate school, both of them vacillated between lectern and pulpit, academy and the parish, as their career calling. Both bore an ecumenical and internationalist vision of a beloved community in which the peoples of the world are one. And both pursued peace and justice as the way of Jesus, and in particular, like Gandhi, the Sermon on the Mount. Both were inspired to nonviolence by the Sermon on the Mount, and both of them turned to the Hindu Gandhi and his ways for the practical pursuit of Christian nonviolence. Both of them drew upon Gandhi's Anglican friend, Charles Andrews. Bonhoeffer tapped, who was a priest in the Anglican Church. Bonhoeffer tapped Andrews to help secure an invitation from Gandhi to India. Bonhoeffer thought Gandhi's ashram would be the kind of school of discipleship that the confessing church needed in Germany. King, this is later, of course, for King, tapped Andrews for his exposition of Gandhi's ideas. Both of them, Bonhoeffer and King, earned doctorates in liberal Protestant theology, albeit different versions, Boston Personalism for King and Schleiermacher, Harnack, Ritschl, the German liberals for Bonhoeffer. Both of them challenged their liberal theology, and both of them became theologians of the cross, a theology whose love and justice included a tragic view of life and human nature, with the cross at the very center. Both were fierce in their refusal to compromise with evil in high places, including high places backed by standing law and the police powers of the state. Both of them might have remained in safety, yet both of them returned home to danger out of a sense of responsibility and calling and belonging. King from Boston to the Jim Crow South, and Bonhoeffer from Union Seminary in New York City back to Berlin in 1939. Both did prison time, and both wrote Christian classics from prison. King's Letter from Birmingham Jail, Bonhoeffer's Letters and Papers from Prison. He didn't know that would be a Christian classic. He didn't know it would ever be published as that. There were letters to his friends and family. At the end, both of them identified with Moses, standing atop Mount Nebo, peering into the promised land that each knew he would not enter. This was King's image in the sermon preached the night before he was assassinated. This was Bonhoeffer's image in one of his very last poems entitled The Death of Moses. Both are now Protestant saints, remembered in statuary, in sacred and in public places. Well, the coincidence is startling because these were very different men, different times, different continents, different faith traditions, different churches, different cultures, nations, education, circumstances, and race. If each has become a universal figure, it was because each was like that strange little brown man they both admired, Gandhi. Universal in his own backyard, true to his own people and place. Now take the coincidences and the differences one level deeper. What we find is that each is at heart a theologian of solidarity and sociality. I put it on the board up here. Or you could say relationality and mutuality. Or you could say theologian of social ecology and reciprocity. Each is a communitarian for whom the well-being of the other, including the enemy, is placed in the same moral framework as one's own well-being. The relationship of self to other is one of equal regard. Nicely captured by Josiah Young in his book on Bonhoeffer entitled No Difference in the Fair. It's also profoundly ecological in a social sense, perfectly captured by King. In the words from prison, we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. And Bonhoeffer says much the same in the little book, Life Together. His subject there is specifically a Christian community, not all society and not all humanity, like King's. But since for Bonhoeffer the reality of the world and the reality of God participate together in one another and both have their center in Jesus Christ, his description of Christian community pertains more broadly, and in fact that's what he did. He expanded it to all in the book Ethics. This is a quotation though from Life Together. In a Christian community, everything depends on whether each individual is an indispensable link in a chain. The chain is unbreakable only when even the smallest link holds tightly with the others. Every Christian community must know that not only do the weak need the strong, but also the strong need the weak. The elimination of the weak is the death of community. The elimination of the weak is the death of community is not a general socio-ecological truth only. It's very specific and very contextual. In Germany, the remaining Jews have been rendered weak, as Bonhoeffer is writing this, 1937. They have been deprived of the rights that they held under the Weimar Constitution. Much of their property has been confiscated, their businesses boycotted in their persons, maligned. The weak are the Jews. And he writes an essay on the church and the Jews, even earlier than this. But the weak also refer to those whom the Nazis have labeled Lebensunwertes Leben, life unworthy of life. These were persons with genetic and other disabilities who were subjected to race-based medical practices. Experiments of all kinds. Many of them were euthanized. For Bonhoeffer, just as the chain would have been unbreakable had solidarity with them been maintained, so also their deaths and the breaking of the chain meant the fracture and the death of the whole community. Germany is over as a great civilization when the weak have been euthanized or taken to the camps or disenfranchised. It's a version of King's injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. All right, so you have this communitarian theology of solidarity. It's also a very this-worldly one that generates motive and energy for transformation. And one of the means of energy is nonviolent resistance, while the ends are the very concrete ends of rights for the disenfranchised, working in King's case for a different socioeconomic order in the United States, and Bonhoeffer's case for what the resistance movement simply called the other Germany, and working for the well-being of future generations. Bonhoeffer writes a letter, and after 10 years on the lessons of resistance to his colleagues in the movement, and says, the question is not how do we heroically extricate ourselves from this affair, but how the future future generations are to live. So that's what I'll say about them, and a little bit about context, and then we'll go to our questions. As Ellen brought up this morning, all prophetic utterances, however widely they may pertain, are initially addressed to the grave issues of the present, the issues of the day, where the prophets are at home. Now, in the cases of King and Bonhoeffer, their contexts are really quite different in some ways, not in others. King's communitarianism, or his communalism, while in line with one of the languages, cultural languages, of the United States, namely biblical and republican, small r, communitarianism, runs counter to the dominant language in this society, which is American economic and therapeutic individualism. The black churches that nurtured King and the prophetic social gospel ministry were both countercultural and minority traditions in a nation imbued with this economic and therapeutic individualism. Their very status as marginal communities, with their own distinctive culture of biblical and republican communitarianism, provided fertile ground for risking resistance when the time ripened. Bonhoeffer's case is very different. He knew, as did the whole Bonhoeffer family, and they were all involved in the resistance movement from the outset, he knew at the very outset of Hitler's accession to power that the church's form and spirituality were not up to the challenge of the new Germany. The church needed to be born anew. King's black churches, nurtured as marginal minority churches, were not Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer was in the Protestant church that had served as a chaplain to the dominant strata of German society. So when Hitler captured much of the country, Bonhoeffer knew that the churches were not up to this enthusiasm for German rebirth. The church needed to be born anew in a disciplined life in a new monasticism, initially strange to German Protestants. When the seminarians arrived at Finkenwalde and they were told to keep the hours, and there was monastic disciplines, they were shocked. We're not Catholics, we're Protestants. This would have to be a new community of formation and dissent, both together. Such a path was utterly alien to a church accustomed to privilege and well settled into its roles as court chaplain, keeper of bourgeois culture, and the agent of social cohesion. Bonhoeffer's communalism wasn't counter to a dominant culture of individualism, as was King's. On the contrary, Germans had a strong sense of corporate identity that nurtured personal sacrifice for Das Vaterland. Rather, Bonhoeffer's communalism was counter to a cultural Christianity that gave no offense. This is from 1934. Christianity stands or falls with its revolutionary protest against violence, arbitrariness, and pride of power, and with its apologia for the weak. I feel that Christianity is doing too little in showing these points, is rather doing too little in showing these points than doing too much. Christianity has adjusted itself much too easily to the worship of power. It should give more offense, more shock to the world than it is doing. Christianity should take a much more definite stand for the weak than to consider the potential right of the strong. Now, those words could have been King's as well, no matter how different the setting. But they were different settings. And so when Bonhoeffer addresses issues of power, it's his focus is on power as it's institutionalized, gone terribly awry, and every kind of everything that was legal became immoral, and everything that was moral was illegal. King, when he talks about power, talks about it in a very different way. It's not the dominating ego and the dominating institutions that get the focus. It's the empowerment of those who aren't yet feeling empowered in their society, and where the first task is to cast off centuries of paralyzing fear. So they come at it quite differently. So in this connection, the first of three lessons that King says he learns from Gandhi is this one. The way of acquiescence leads to moral and spiritual suicide. Giving in to the powers leads to moral and spiritual suicide. That sounds very much in accord with the Prophet of Islam sharing the same struggles as King, namely Malcolm X. And the other two lessons from Gandhi are: the way of violence leads to bitterness in the survivors and brutality in the destroyers. And the third one: the way of nonviolence leads to redemption and the creation of the beloved community. The very last thing I'll say, and then we'll go to these two questions, is if we're looking at the legacies of these two, one of our questions, for the sake of creation justice, for the sake of an earth-honoring faith that for a time of change, even geophysical change, on a tough new planet, then there are ways in which Gandhi was beyond both Bonhoeffer and King, and I just want to share that with you. Gandhi, Bonhoeffer, and King all shared a love of the Sermon on the Mount as prophetic literature and wisdom literature, and an admiration of, on Gandhi's part, of Jesus, and a devotion on King and Bonhoeffer's part to Jesus. But whatever Gandhi's attraction to Jesus, his Hinduism put him beyond Bonhoeffer and King in ways that are important to what King called the world house. In his last book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community, the very last essay is entitled The World House. And listen to this. This is over 50 years ago. Some years ago, and a famous novelist died. Among his papers was found a list of suggested plots for future stories, the most prominently underscored being this one. A widely separated family inherits a house in which they have to live together. This is the great new problem of humankind. We have inherited a large house, a great world house, in which we have to learn to live together. Black and white, Easterner and Westerner, Gentile and Jew, Catholic and Protestant, Muslim and Hindu. A family unduly separated in ideas, cultures, and interests, who, because we can never again live apart, must somehow learn to live with each other in peace. Then he goes on to describe the process of globalization. But let's go back to this Gandhi and the World House of King. The Vedantic Hindu cosmology that Gandhi embraced conceives all of reality as unified and interconnected in such a way that there are no sharp ontological boundaries that separate animate and inanimate. You can't separate the biotic and the abiotic in the end, the animate and the inanimate. Rocks and rivers, as well as trees, are powerful beings that bear the intrinsic value accorded life, or accorded being itself. It's being that has value, not even just life as we define it. Gandhi, from his youth onward, internalized this, and he gave it expression in a life committed to nonviolence and respectful justice towards all creatures. He would speak of his goal as self-realization. Listen closely to this. But it was self-realization of a sort that's very foreign to us when we hear that term, phrase. With the exception of some mystics who would be in his camp. Self-realization for Gandhi is identification with the totality of life. My doctrine, I'm quoting him, means that I must identify myself with life, with everything that lives, and I must share the majority of life in the presence of God. The sum total of this life is God. I believe in the essential unity of humankind, and for that matter, of all that lives. And his ethics, he went on to say, not only permits me to claim, but requires me to own kinship, not merely with the ape, but with the horse and the sheep, the lion and the leopard, the snake and the scorpion. I want to realize brotherhood or identity, not merely with the beings called human, but with all life, even with such things as crawl upon the earth. We claim descent from the same God. And Gandhi was well known for not allowing trees to be cut or snakes to be killed in the ashram. So self-realization in Gandhi's religious and also prophetic ethic thus understood the realized person to see the cosmic self in all beings. Not with the arrogant eye, but with the equal eye. The Bhagavad Gita reads, a true yogi observes me, capital M, in all beings, and also sees every being in me, capital M. Indeed, the self-realized person sees me, the Supreme Lord, everywhere. So in Gandhi's case, this self-realization, identification with all of life, leads him to address social justice, above all, the caste system, the oppressions of the colonial system, and to do so in ways that make nonviolence essential as an encompassing way of life, and not just a shrewd strategy on the part of those that don't have arms to bear or privilege to exercise. And while Bonhoeffer and King have a version of this same thing, in Gandhi, this non-dualism, this insistence on the unity of all life, the biotic and the abiotic, the animate and the inanimate, air, earth, fire, water. Non-dualism has none of the human-centeredness that's typical of Western society and Western culture. Human beings are not ontologically superior to other life forms for Gandhi. We're a species among species in a great drama of life. And it's the liberation of all life, from the cell to the community, to the land, to the sea, soil, the water, that is his, part of his prophetic liberative tradition. So I'm just saying, I think we have some things to learn yet. From Mohandas Gandhi. Okay, where are the women? Because I've only talked about the men. Who are the women? We could have talked about Dorothy Day. Or there would be no Martin Luther King without Rosa Parks. The women in the Bonhoeffer family have never gotten the press that the men have, but those strong women held things together. Yes, who are the women prophets?
Aung San Suu Kyi and Arundhati Roy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Say something about each.
Aung San Suu Kyi is, and I'm not prepared for the best details, but she's in Burma. She's won the Nobel Peace Prize. She's been in, under house arrest for many years.
Decades. She has been there for decades.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised she's still alive, actually.
Yeah. She started very young on this path.
And her father was part of the government in Burma, and she's a voice for the poor, and she just fits all those justice, faith, shared power, unquenchable thirst for life.
Yeah.
And Arundhati Roy is from India, and I believe that she's an architect, and a trained architect. And
she's also a writer.
And she's written a number of books, and one, frankly, depressing novel. Mm-hmm. But she's a spokesperson in a country that doesn't value women that much, for the poor. And she has particularly spoken up about this enormous dam that's going to be displacing millions. India has something like 1.1 billion people in it now, and this dam is going to be displacing millions of people, and she is very outspoken in her speaking truth to power.
Would you repeat her name?
How to spell it?
Arundhati Roy.
Oh.
I'm not sure I'll get Arundhati Roy. Right.
D-A-T-I.
She wrote The God of Small Things.
The God of Small Things, yes. Roy, The God of Small Things. And speaking of India, Vandana Shiva is another one in this tradition who has taken up the cause, especially of farmers who were not supposed to be saving their own seeds, but buying patented seeds. And she, Vandana Shiva, is a nuclear physicist who has taken up the cause of the ecological well-being of communities and the people together. Yes?
What about the African woman?
Wangari Maathai.
For trees.
Yes, mm-hmm. One who recently died. There was a huge service at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York. Wangari Maathai won. Did she win a Nobel Prize?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes, she did. For the green belt movement, planting trees. It started in Kenya and it's gone beyond that. But.
Lema Bowie.
Layla
Bowie, who was the woman who organized the women of Liberia to stop the violence there, and was one of the three women that just got the Nobel Peace Prize.
Tell me your last name again. Bowie?
It's not Bowie, but it's G-B-O-W-E-E.
Bowie. All right. Yes.
Well, there are the nuns on the bus.
Yes.
What?
The nuns on the bus.
Tell us about the nuns on the bus.
Well, they entered my state of Wisconsin and criticized Paul Ryan's budget plan as inconsistent with Catholic social teaching.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing.
So they being targeted by leadership of the Catholic Church.
Yeah. Oh my. And the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility, which tries an organization of religiously based institution that tries to monitor corporations' behavior and then seek through stockholder resolution and negotiations and so on to influence corporate policy. It's the Roman Catholic women religious who have moved into the forefront of that and in their own not so quiet ways sometimes, quiet ways other times, have exercised really remarkable power.
Is that why the Vatican is investigating?
It's a complex story, but yeah. Okay, other nominations.
We're trying to remember a name from Guatemala, but
Roberto Manchu.
Oh, yes.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah,
thank you. Roberto
Manchu.
But she's everywhere you go in those countries too. To hear what's going on and who's really been active, it's almost always women who are leading and led through the wars. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And And my skewing this presentation in favor of exemplars who are men really does skew the whole picture.
Yeah.
Because even for a couple of reasons, even when there is often extraordinary leadership on the part of some particular figure, Desmond Tutu in South Africa, Martin Luther King in the United States, they have no power apart from people power. They have no power apart from the rank and file. If it doesn't become a movement of some kind or another, then those ends are not achieved. And more often than not, it's been the women who have carried the movement. Those are the folks in the church basement you need to watch out for.
Sophie Scholz.
Sophie Scholz in Germany. Yes. One of the leaders among the German students, university students in the underground, in the resistance movement against Hitler. Yeah, Peter.
Barbara Deming.
Barbara Deming. Tell us about Barbara Deming.
How many people ever heard her name? She really fits with these in that she's a great intellect and a great writer about nonviolent resistance, particularly civil disobedience, and largely overlooked and studied with some of these people. She's no longer with us. But came at all of these issues from a secular perspective. And began with civil rights right up to the GLBT movement and now it's passed away. New York City.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of Bella Abzug and her hat.
Well, moving into our own realm from the global realm, I would nominate Rebecca Larson, who, with her team at the World Council, and won the Nobel Peace Prize, and then subsequently was the head of social justice for the ELCA and shepherded through the whole church through the process of making the decision on ordination of gays and lesbians. She hasn't gotten much publicity, but she has a Nobel Peace Prize hanging on her wall. You should know her more. She's been here.
Yeah, she has. Yep.
Did she get the Peace Prize for the anti-mine or the GLB?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
For work that she did in the 1980s.
Okay, Tempus is fugiting here. How do we extend the legacies of these women and men in the interests of planetary health, in the interests of creation, justice as a whole? I don't expect us to do much of that in a couple of minutes. And that's where I want to leave us, is with that question. And the ways will be small. If you look back at these, whether it's Rosa Parks, you know, and the Highland School in Tennessee, training young civil rights leaders and then refusing to sit down on the bus. Or it doesn't really matter where you look, these are all kind of mustard seed stories. It's almost always a small group of determined folk who have a sense of belonging to something that surpasses their own moment in time for a cause they may not see one in their own time, but they live by a faith that stretches out to encompass future generations and even, in Gandhi's case, some sense of a belonging to a cosmic self. But it's almost always starting in a small group that then when the time is ripe, what King called the zeitgeist, when the time is ripe, then becomes a movement. And then it has to make its way to the centers of of power and have enough power and persuasion to make a difference there. So King meeting with Lyndon Johnson and the Civil Rights Act and so on. Paul? But it starts small.
I think, too, that maybe going beyond the point of an individual personality, but I'm looking at a Harriet Beecher Stowe, Uncle Tom's Cabin, a seminal work, or Silent Spring. Right?
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm
Rachel Carson.
Will somebody write the seminal book relative to the environmental issue that would focus attention on it in a way that it goes somewhere?
Yeah, yeah. There are these seminal works, but the trouble is you don't know that.
Yeah.
I mean, Rachel Carson, when she wrote Silent Spring, didn't know that that was going to kick off the environment.
She didn't live long enough to see it, did
she? No, she didn't. No. Yeah. So you be as faithful as you can be. You do the right thing. And the rest is in the hands of God and the powers unleashed by doing the right thing. Thanks. Okay.